Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Dune and the Velvet Underground, starting with Dune, which everybody has been waiting with bated breath for this movie to come out. Because for one reason, they're hoping that it will save the theaters. So this is going to be one of the movies that will bring people back into the theaters and turn around all of their finances. So lots of expectations. And of course, Dune was made in 1984 by David Lynch. This is a completely different take with Denis Villeneuve. Where do we start with Dune, Mike? It's such a big topic to get our arms around. Where do we start with Dune?
Well, it's such a big topic that I'll start off by just openly declaring I have not read the 1965 Frank Herbert novel that's the source for it, all 900 pages, whatever. And yet, you know, I mean, I don't read a lot of science fiction, but I'm certainly aware of it. And I'm also aware of how I responded, how almost everybody responded to David Lynch's 1984 adaptation, which was a critical and commercial bomb, not just a failure, but a bomb. And indeed, Lynch himself disowned the film as it was finally edited and so on, and just kind of, you know, walked away there. My sense of Lynch's version was, aside from a few striking shots, a little bit of the sort of trademark Lynchian surrealism, it was a total mess. And for me, it was, and I have a book about Dune, actually, I mean, in terms of what went wrong. But in a nutshell, it's essentially one of these big budget films that goes off the rails. You know what I mean? And once it starts to go wrong, it's almost like too late to stop it. And by the time it gets into post-production and studio is editing it as they're going to release it, Lynch himself disowned the film. So a lot of the anticipation for this new version of Dune by Denis Villeneuve is the fact that it's not the David Lynch film all these years later, from 1984 to 2021, to get it right, if you will. Now, I'm not in a position from a literary standpoint to say exactly what's true to the novel and what's not and so on. But from what I've read, it's truer to the novel, truer to the spirit of the novel and the facts of it than Lynch's kind of crackpot, campy version was. And so that certainly works in its favor. Now, as we're talking about it, Marie and I today, the film had a really strong opening weekend, as they say. Now, what makes me smile is Denis Villeneuve had declared already in interviews that his film would really just be part of the story because it's a sprawling story, all those hundreds of pages. And what makes me smile is that when you watch his version of Dune, right in the opening credits, it says Dune Part 1. So right there on the screen, I know this is only going to be Part 1. Now, for me, the downside of that was that much of the film played like what I call an extended prologue. So much of it seemed like it was setting up storylines and conflicts and all, not all of them fully resolved here. But, you know, when the film runs, you know, 155 minutes, that's a lot of prologue. And so it is satisfying on a scripted level, but I oftentimes felt like it's still setting things up for further installments, like the beginning of a new Star Wars enterprise or something is setting a lot of stuff up. And to me, that kind of hurt it a bit. Now, where they're somewhat coy is, because it says Part 1, you just know there's going to be more coming, right? But leading up to the release of the film, the director and the studio and others were all saying, well, we're not sure yet if we're going to do more. It all depends on how it opens. And I thought, yeah, but it opens saying Part 1. But then several days after, like a few days after the opening weekend, when it just did so well, both in theaters and streaming, did so well, they officially announced just a few days before Marie and I are talking right now that yes, indeed, we're going to make Part 2 and it'll come out in 2023 and so on. And there's so much story that they could deal with here based on what I've read about the book that you could easily envision chapter after chapter of it. And, you know, although I've got mixed feelings about this version of Dune, commercially and critically, it has done extremely well. There's a fan base for it, for sure. And I think we are really on the launching pad for yet another saga that's going to play out for quite a few episodes over quite a few years. You know, years from now, they'll wheel me out and I'll talk about Part 7 or Part 8 or something. And I'm not averse to that. I mean, I think it actually, on its sci-fi terms, works quite well, both thematically and certainly visually.
Now, if, you know, for people who have read the book, I think it is a welcome return to the Duneverse, if I can coin that word, because it's a very complicated story that unfolds, like you said, over 900 pages. So I think that's why it has such a long running time, that there's just so much information to get in there. And there's still probably half the book left to do in you know, part two. So there's just a lot of exposition that just needs to happen to explain this world. However, you did say Star Wars, so I have to jump in here to say that Villeneuve said he hoped to make it the Star Wars he never saw. In an interview, he explained that most of the main ideas of Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, came from Dune. So it will be a challenge to tackle the project. In a way, it's Star Wars for adults. What's also funny is that Oscar Isaac plays a character in Dune, Leto Atreides. And, you know, he plays Dameron Poe in the Star Wars movie franchise. So it's almost like a little inside joke there. But what do you think of the inevitable comparisons between Dune and Star Wars? And do you agree with Villeneuve that Dune is Star Wars for adults?
You know, I'm not the biggest fan of these films, and I'm always upfront about that. But by the same token, trying to be objective, considering Dune and Star Wars, I would definitely agree with him. There are a number of really capable actors in Dune, and they are showcased. You really get a sense of performance here, which you don't always get fully in some of the Star Wars episodes. Between all the, you know, saber warfare and explosions and people in heavy suits and everything, but here you have a fuller sense of character than you often will get in Star Wars. And I know real Star Wars fans will jump on me for that, but I think that's Denis Villeneuve's assessment, and I think he's right about that. And I think the subject matter is more mature in a lot of ways, and cinematically the treatment of it, I think, plays better to an adult audience. He does, and he's very careful about this. He's really clever about this. There are plenty of fights, a lot of explosions. You get your action sequences, but it's not just one action sequence after another, which the Star Wars movies tend to become. Here, there are much quieter, kind of contemplative, meditative scenes almost, where you really can, you know, think about principal characters and what all this means for them. And not that you don't get that in Star Wars, but I think you get more of that here. So I think his quote is well grounded, that this is actually like a more adult treatment, what otherwise might seem like really similar material. And I think that very much plays to advantage. The final observation along those lines is, in Star Wars, so much is based quite literally on CGI. There's just so much, it's a bombardment of special effects. You have that here in Dune. He knows box office. He knows what audiences want today. He also knows audiences, or at least some audiences, also want things to be more psychologically and physically grounded. To the credit of Villeneuve's version of Dune, there's a lot of actual location shooting in Jordan and elsewhere in the Middle East. And because the story primarily takes place on a desert planet, you really have a sense of actual desert, because much of it was shot in actual desert. You can tell where special effects come in, of course, but you can also tell when you're in a real desert that way. And that's why, as people have made comparisons with really grandiose and panoramic filmmaking, like inevitably Lawrence of Arabia, you know, you're going to have scenes there, some of the wide shots. And this is a movie to be seen in theaters, because you want those really wide shots, and you also want the sound, the way it's not just the composed music, but the overall sound design. You want the full visual and aural effect of that on a big screen with a great sound system and so on. But the fact that you really are immersed in a desert environment, that's really significant. And I've been sort of mentally quipping about this and thinking about, you know, there are those comparisons with Lawrence of Arabia. And because our protagonist here is named Paul, I've started referring to the film as Paul of Arabia. I mean, it really kind of plays out that way. And I think that's to the advantage of the film, because it has a human base to it, and it makes you care about characters in a way that, yes, back to your use of his quotation, Marie, that it is like, you know, that kind of material, but really pitched more at adults, which is not to say kids won't enjoy it, but that adult audiences can really fully appreciate it.
I think there is a lot of detail to absorb. So I think maybe that's part of it, that, you know, you need a real attention span and the ability to, you know, remember what you saw, because everything builds on what you've seen previously. Now, I'm glad you brought up the desert, because one thing I thought was really beautifully done is, if you see this, and you have to see it in the theater, if you see it in 3D, one of the things about the world of Dune is, you know, the spice that is, you know, endemic to the area. And there are moments in the 3D where the flecks of the spice are floating in the air, and it's absolutely enthralling. There are moments in the film where the cinematography is just incredible. And I think that part of it was done really well. The problem with shooting so much of the desert is it's very hard to make a desert interesting for minutes after minutes after minutes. You know, there's a starkness to it, there's a beauty to it, but it's just not as exciting to look at as, you know, something with more details in the background.
I agree with you completely. On the one hand, there is a great sense of detail in this film. And in fact, the director has bemoaned the fact that this film would be released simultaneously in theaters and for streaming. He initially thought it would be like theater release only, you know, at first. And he's been kind of bitter in some of his interviews. And he's right. He talked about the costuming, the details you get in some of the costuming. You can only fully appreciate like on a big screen. Also, the sound design that I mentioned earlier, that you really want like an exceptional sound system to have that play to the fullest. But Marie, your point is very well taken about the desert. As visually striking as that is, there's only so much you can do with it. You're absolutely right. And one of my reservations about this film is it knows the effect it's having, and it tends to linger on that effect. There are a lot of scenes that are held, I mean, I'm all for contemplative cinema, but there are scenes where like it's like count the beats. It's almost a musical thing. Count the beats, where he'll hold a shot probably 10 seconds longer than he needs to. And that adds up, doesn't it? And you start to have a movie that's going to look push towards 3 hours because almost every scene is held a little longer than it really needs to be. And, you know, it's not a major reservation I have, but it was a kind of nagging reservation. Scene by scene, I thought, you know, you could tighten it a little bit without losing the overall effect.
Once you go over 2 hours, I'm with you. I'm looking for things that they could have tightened up or eliminated altogether. I think most movies shouldn't be more than 2 hours unless there's a really compelling reason. If only because by the time you sat through the previews, we're really talking about 3 hours. That's a long time to expect people to sit there and watch something. And I wanted to ask you what you thought about Timothée Chalamet as the updated Paul Atreides. You know, I thought just in terms of the hair, he was a great update from Kyle MacLachlan from the 1984 Dune, because both of these actors just have amazing hair. I mean, I know that sounds funny to say, but I thought it was immediately obvious who the star was. And that worked to me. It was an updated Kyle MacLachlan.
Well, I didn't think we were talking about hair design as well, but you're absolutely right, Marie. The way that, you know, really dark, really black hair, the way it's sculpted, if you will, you know, visually it catches your attention, doesn't it? And they hold the screen. I had mixed and ultimately negative feelings about Timothée Chalamet as the lead. I'll tell you why. It's an intriguing notion because he's not the conventional action hero. And there are jokes early in the film. I'm glad they don't go overboard with it, but there are a few jokes about, well, you know, have you put on any muscle, whatever? And well, no, not really. Because he really is like the proverbial 98-pound weakling, right? I mean, for an action movie hero, you know, he's really kind of slender that way. Here's the thing that struck me as mixed to negative. In large sections of the film where he's meant to be a sensitive protagonist, this is a skilled actor. He knows how to play sensitive. And the fact that he's slightly built kind of works to advantage, almost like an underdog appeal, like this guy is going to be our hero. You know, he doesn't have much by way of biceps, but he'll flex what he has and he'll win. He'll get ahead. So I'm sympathetic on that score. However, as the movie moves along, you get into some action set pieces where at certain points, the good guy has to fight a bad guy. You know what? There are several fight scenes. Watch how they're shot, because the director and cinematographer had to be keenly aware of this. They are tightly framed, a lot of quick cuts, because you don't want to call attention to the fact that you have your, you know, rather underwhelming, I mean, physically underwhelming protagonist, Paul, up against these muscle-bound tough guys who look like they could snap him in two. But the way that's being shot, you know, he's going to emerge victorious in some of these encounters. But they're so careful and so quick with the framing and the editing that it doesn't give us time to linger over the kind of near preposterous notion that this little guy's going to go in and just beat up all the, not just bad guys, but big bad guys, right? And I want to get your thoughts on this, Marie, because that's a point where I thought there are scenes later on where he has become our hero. He's got to save his people, the great white savior, if you will, for a planet even. And yet, you know, you need to have some kind of strength, if not actual swaggering at that point. And Timothée Chalamet just doesn't quite have that. And it's not a knock against him. He's a really good actor in certain roles. I don't think he's the right actor for this role. And I finally, having been intrigued initially and going along with the sensitive scenes, by the end of the film, I just thought to the extreme of thinking that he was actually miscast. I didn't think he was very convincing in many of the later scenes of what's a very long film.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think he's having a moment, though. I mean, he's in a lot of things now. So I think this was his moment to be this star in this movie. But yes, he's physically unconvincing as the warrior. By the time you get to the end of the movie, it just seems like he is, you know, the pretty face for the character. Now, I did like Jason Momoa. And I have to say, there's so many big names in this movie. There's a reason for everybody to go to this movie. Somebody you like is in this movie, almost assuredly. And they've even got, you know, a little bit of a who's who in space world. Patrick Stewart shows up in a small role. And like you said, they showcase these people. It's like, oh, good. Now we get to see, you know, Jason Momoa. I thought that was, and Josh Brolin. I mean, there's just a whole lot of people in there worth watching, but it's almost too much. It's almost, you know, because you're waiting for them to come back on the screen, and some of them just have a small role because there's just so much to get through, to get through the movie. Were there any actors who stood out to you or who you particularly enjoyed watching in this movie?
Well, Maria, I'm going to give the proverbial yes and no answer. There are a lot of talented actors here, and it's good to see them, and they do well with the role. But you know what? By the same token, it ultimately is kind of distracting. You want to get fully pulled into the story, and then you think, oh, there's so-and-so, and there's so-and-so, and it does sort of pulls you away. Sometimes the movie references are correspondingly distracting. Yes, the Lawrence of Arabia analogies are all there. It's Paul of Arabia. Yeah, and that basically works for me. But some of the movie quotes, if you will, you know, the influences that the director has acknowledged can be kind of distracting. So when you mention famous actors showing up, Stellan Skarsgård shows up as one of the bad guys, a baron. And that sequence and his physical appearance, his bald-headed, overweight appearance, he looks so much like Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now that it really is like lifted from Apocalypse Now. And the directors acknowledge that as a direct influence. But for me, that's actually something that as a movie geek, yeah, I smile, I appreciate it. Oh, you know, he's acknowledging, you know, Apocalypse Now. But, you know, even though on the face of it, as a movie geek, I can like that. Ultimately, I don't like it. I'll tell you why, because I want to be on this desert planet pulled into this story. And suddenly I'm thinking about how clever it is that they've worked in an Apocalypse Now reference. But why, right? It doesn't, like, in terms of scripted logic, it doesn't really belong there. And it's dwelled on in a way. I mean, very well shot, but I'm thinking, you know, this could be an outtake of Marlon Brando from Apocalypse Now. Why are we getting this? You know, you didn't have to give him that appearance. Let me get your thoughts on that, because that's why I said it was a proverbial yes and no answer, that, yeah, it's great to see all these actors and some of the movie references, but sometimes that amounts to a kind of visual and film historical clutter.
I think that's a great way of putting it. And I think if he had not indulged himself in all of those reflective moments, again, they could have cut this runtime down. In terms of Villeneuve, though, you know, I think he's done better sci-fi with Arrival in 2016 and Blade Runner in 2017. I don't think Dune is the best of those three. I'd put it in, you know, third place. What about you?
You know, Marie, basically, I agree with you. I think of the sci-fi, he's done a variety of films, but of the sci-fi films you mentioned, I think Arrival is probably the most successful of them. It really, it's cohesive. It really holds together well, has a nice pace to it. So from a storytelling standpoint, I think it works the best. To his credit, you know, from what I know of Dune, the sprawling saga, it'd be difficult for any director to fully pull that together. And I think he does a reasonably good job of that. And, you know, the fact that we will now have part two, there are a lot of people looking forward to that. It's going to be another blockbuster. And even though I'm not a huge fan of the genre, I'm looking forward to it. I mean, there are enough story elements here. I want to see how they play out in the next installment. So if you can win me over, you can probably win almost any moviegoer over. So yeah, I think he's done better sci-fi work, but the short answer is he works well within that genre. He knows how to oversee that kind of science fiction spectacle.
Any awards do you think are going to happen for this movie?
Marie, I think yes, certainly in technical categories. And because it has been, for the most part, critically well-received and commercially, you know, doing extremely well as we speak, it seems to me that, you know, because the list of Best Picture nominations seems to always grow year by year, and you can include a lot of things there, it would have a shot even at that, I'd say, because there's such a loyal and clamorous fan base for this, that it's a film people are talking. This is the big season now for awards recognition in terms of releasing movies now, that, you know, within a few weeks, we'll be getting actual nominations in various awards. So the timing is very deliberate that way. And so I think it probably will certainly get a lot of nominations. You know, I don't have the crystal ball for what's being nominated, much less what'll win, but I would put it on the short list of films that will get certainly technical nominations, a lot of them. I don't think necessarily it'll get acting nominations, but it could well get, you know, for director and picture and so on. And for screenplay, I mean, it's a difficult screenplay to pull off. And I thought they did a reasonably good job of capturing at least some of the novel. And of course, part two will give us more, and then part 10 will give us the rest, I guess.
You know, Mike, one of the things that I was looking for in the movie was the return of the sandworms, you know, the coolest part of the 1984 movie, even if it was a bomb. And I don't think it's disappointing what they do with the sandworms in this one. But what did you think?
In the David Lynch version, the sandworms are prominently there. It's one of the Lynchian touches, that kind of surreal horror of the sandworms. What I preferred about the treatment of the sandworms here was that they were treated in an almost subliminal way, literally beneath the earth. So many scenes have the sands shifting, the sands moving, and you know the worms are down there somewhere. When the worms actually appear, it's often very quickly and like that quick horror effect, but the camera and the editing, they don't linger. And for me, it was actually scarier that way. You know, this is a desert planet, and those enormous worms are down there, and occasionally you'll see them moving under the sand, or when you do see them moving, it's so quickly that it scares you just because you didn't quite see it completely. It's like blink and it's gone. I loved one of the film reviews that referred to the sandworms as vacuum cleaner attachments gone rogue. they are like these tubes that are suddenly popping up from the earth. And again, I think sometimes horror is most effective. And the original Alien was like this, that horror is most effective when you don't fully see the monster. You just see it for a moment or two. Because when you show it in full, as horrible as it might be, after a few minutes, almost any viewer is going to say, okay, that's the monster. But when you don't fully see it, it's in the shadows or it's under the sand, your imagination takes over and then it's really scary. So to the credit of how the director handles it in Dune, I thought that was a very smart move. Don't show the sandworms very often or for very long. And after all, we've got many episodes ahead where those sandworms can have a starring role, right? They don't have to have a starring role in part one. We know they're there.
Now, it's interesting what you said about monsters, because Steven Spielberg was interviewed talking about Jaws. And he said, you know, the funny thing was that, you know, the shark would only look real for like 23 frames, you know, but once you went to 24, suddenly it looked fake. So, you know, you just had to be very careful about how you presented the monster. So you got a glimpse and the rest of it was really just in your head.
Well, you're right. But the distinction there is when Spielberg was making Jaws, released way back in 1975, they had a mechanical shark that was nicknamed Bruce and it kept breaking down. And Spielberg couldn't shoot it for very long without it breaking down or just looking fake. And so he turned adversity to advantage. And I've heard Spielberg in interviews talk about this, where he said, you know what? We don't have to show it for 2 minutes at a time, show it for 2 seconds. And it's much scarier. And people won't realize just how fake it is. So there was a very pragmatic reason for that, but creatively it was inspired. That shark is so scary. And when you have the John Williams music, which is really terrifying, and just a glimpse of the shark, it really just scares you so much. And I think, Marie, you're right, though, like conceptually, you're better off not fully having the big reveal. Here's the monster. Because it's really, really scary when you see the sand is moving around in a way. And, you know, there's some enormous sandworm right under the surface, and it might get you at any moment.
Well, we need to move on to our second film because we're actually only have 5 minutes left. Last word on Dune, though, even though it's on HBO Max, go see it in the theater. So the other movie we're going to talk about is The Velvet Underground, which is kind of a behind the music treatment of, you know, whatever happened to, you know, you get the basics of this really avant-garde band, which gave us, you know, Lou Reed and some other notables. And it is directed by Todd Haynes. But honestly, I just didn't see Todd Haynes in this at all. I mean, I'm so used to him doing really quirky stuff like the superstar Karen Carpenter story, which was told with Barbie dolls, or, you know, I'm thinking of the movie Carol, which had so many beautiful Hitchcock references and call outs and stuff like that. This to me seemed so unoriginally put together. I mean, it really just looked like something you'd see on VH1. Behind the music. What was your take on the movie and the topic?
I had a different take on it. I actually saw Lou Reed in concert a couple times. I've had a very strong interest in his career. I've met his widow, Laurie Anderson, and seen her in concert. I mean, I really identify with the material strongly. Moreover, the film is dedicated to Jonas Mekas, the late underground filmmaker and writer, whom I'd met when he was in his 90s. And the film incorporates actual clips from so many avant-garde films. And I actually had taught a course on avant-garde cinema. So, so many clips that I used in my course. So on a very selfish level, I was seeing clips that I'm very familiar with. In terms of the storytelling, I actually liked the film a lot. One reason I liked it is that, you know, when Lou Reed was working very closely with not just the Velvet Underground, but with Andy Warhol, essentially the manager of the band back in the late 60s, the multimedia shows they would put on, which did incorporate avant-garde filmmaking. And I saw this very much as of a piece. And Todd Haynes, being much younger, still emotionally and film historically identifies with that period very closely. So I agree with you that Todd Haynes is best known for melodramas. Far From Heaven would be one, Carol would be another, you know, Douglas Sirk type melodramas. And he's a, I love his films. I really like him a lot. But I do see him as actually a perfect candidate to make a documentary about the Velvet Underground for the reasons that I identify. But also think back to his film, Velvet Goldmine, which is about glam rock. So he's made at least one feature film overtly about a slightly later period in rock music history. But he knows this material really well. And I like the way it was interwoven, contemporary modern interviews with the surviving band members, just a couple at this point, but then also a lot of archival footage. I loved reading the end credits. So many of the films that were used, so many of the references, it's a really rich source there. And I just find it really kind of mesmerizing to watch because I think he very skillfully weaves all that together.
I think you'll probably like this movie best if you already know something about the band. Or people who came out of the band like Lou Reed. Otherwise, I found it to be a miss. It didn't intrigue me enough to make me go back and look up their records. It is, by the way, streamable on Apple TV because I don't even think it's opened around here, although I know it opened at the Charles. Was there very many people there that day?
Yeah, and in fact, when I saw it at the Charles Theater, there was a good turnout and enough people who would have known this band well. So Maria, I agree with you strongly in that this is really a movie for people who know the Velvet Underground, who know that period, who know the avant-garde filmmakers that I referenced very quickly before. I don't want to make it seem like it's alienating to anyone else, but I think it's playing very much to that kind of fan base. If I were not a Velvet Underground fan, which I am big time, I think I would have sat there wondering, well, who's this? What's that? I would have felt kind of distanced from it. So Maria, I'm agreeing with you on that point. If you know about The Velvet Underground, definitely see the film. If you don't know or don't really care for them that much, I would say it would be a miss in the sense that it's not likely to win new fans. I mean, what do you think of that? It's not an open and welcoming film that way. It's kind of playing to the crowd that knows this material already.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on the money with that. It's for existing fans. It's not meant to get new ones. And if you are a fan, you definitely should. You definitely should see this. But that brings us to the end of our show. But don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and on Pandora. And we will see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.